The aroma and taste of a bold Cabernet, the smooth, delicate finish of an earthy Pinot Noir, the crisp effervescence of a glass of sparkling wine. Though most of us have at least a passing familiarity with the taste of wine, many of us have no idea just how long and labor-intensive the winemaking process is. Even if we're one of the lucky ones who have visited a working winery, behind the scenes, it's a totally different world. The growing, harvesting, and finesse that goes into crafting a great bottle of wine all starts at the vineyard itself. But can it be done in a sustainable yet cost-effective way? As concerns around farming sustainability become more heightened, our guest today, a winemaker and founder of an electric autonomous tractor company, has figured out a way to use electric and autonomous technology to accelerate his vision of clean, sustainable farming. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, and on the Future Car Podcast, when we talk autonomous vehicles, they're usually on the road. But a great application for autonomous and even electric vehicles is agriculture and farming. Row after row of crops provide a well-defined path to follow, just like those perfectly painted lines you want on a city street to help you control an autonomous car. Today, we talk about a particular type of agriculture, growing grapes and working in vineyards. We have with us Carlo Mondavi, grandson of Napa Valley winemaking icon Robert Mondavi. Carlo is a vintner himself, and he also is a founder and chief farming officer of Monarch Tractor, a maker of autonomous electric tractors. It's going to be an interesting conversation as Carlo explains to us how to achieve cost-effective, sustainable, herbicide-free farming with an autonomous tractor that seems a bit like a giant harvesting Roomba. Carlo, welcome to the Future Car Podcast.
Thank you, Ed. Very kind, and thank you for the kind introduction. It's good to be here.
So, Carlo, tell us a little bit about Monarch Tractor, what it's all about, how it came about.
It's been an incredible journey. I'll just kind of start by saying that I never planned to be involved in a technology business. It's something that I enjoy technology. I enjoy knowing when severe weather's coming. I enjoy that as a farmer and in the winery, just being able to understand what's tracking fermentations, et cetera. But it wasn't something that I had planned on. But I got into kind of a hard place. I had begun a challenge called the Monarch Challenge, which was a challenge to basically create a conversation within my farming community of Northern California, so Sonoma, Napa, kind of Mendocino area, about how certain chemicals that are being used in agriculture are dangerous and unhealthy. So things like herbicides, neonicotinoids, stuff like that. And just to create awareness, because a lot of people didn't know. In fact, when I began the Monarch Challenge back in 2016, none of the lawsuits had been going on that you know, have made now people now know that things like Roundup are linked to cancer, et cetera. But I began this challenge. And the reason why we called it the Monarch Challenge was because since the introduction of herbicides, of really the introduction of Roundup, in 1974, the monarch population of butterflies has declined by 99%. In fact, this last winter's count done by the Xerxes Society, that's an incredible organization that they've dedicated their time to invertebrates, so mostly insects and whatnot. And since the introduction and the beginning of Xerxes, so Xerxes has been keeping the count since the 80s. So back in the 80s, when they began the count, they were counting of the westerly monarchs, about 5 million monarchs migrating through the state of California down on their way to Mexico. And this last winter's count in 2020, they counted 1,910 individuals. And so when I found out about the collapse of the kind of monarch population, colony collapse with the bees, the destruction that herbicides have on our soil microbiome and farm biology and all the things downriver from that, I said, I have to create awareness. Like the human health impact is one thing, but as humans, we're free to learn. We're free to do whatever we want. And I don't want to impede on people's freedom, but I do want to create awareness about things that are not free to make those decisions like in, within our environment. So began the Monarch Challenge. That I got a big splash of cold water in late 2016, early 2017. I would go talk to friends and they would say, and so this is a long way around at about the beginning of how I got involved in technology, but I'd go talk to my farming friends and neighbors and they'd say, I love our planet. I love our farm, but I've got to put food on the table for my family. I've got to put my kids through college. This practice of not using herbicides and this cleaner kind of practice costs more, not a lot more, but enough to make an impact for my family. And so I can't do it. And I realized quickly that there was a cost divide that was too great for most farms to take. And then within the, you know, some of these companies, they would say, well, you think you're holier than thou by protecting the soil microbiome and the farm biology and being beyond organic. That's something Dante, my brother, and I, founder Ram, we've been beyond organic for a long, long time. My family has, but you think you're better than all of us conventional farmers, but you're burning more diesel to be organic. You have to do more passes in the field because the chemicals you're using, even though they're organic, they have a shorter half-life. So you have to use them more often. And to be honest, they're right. Organic farming comes with a greater carbon footprint in many areas. I realized that the chances of the Monarch Challenge succeeding were little. I realized one day, we're super blessed in Northern California. Silicon Valley is right over the other side of the bay. I realized if you can drive a Tesla down a freeway at 70 miles per hour, pop it in ludicrous mode, have it change lanes, why couldn't you take a tractor 2 and 3 miles per hour down the vineyard and do your work autonomously? And so this idea of being able to create an autonomous tractor that was electric started to kind of become something that I was like, this is the solution to the Monarch Challenge. Meanwhile, in 2017, something hit me really hard. My family, we had our first sobering of climate change, which was the wildfires of 2017 that hit Napa, Sonoma, and Mendocino. Burnt thousands of structures. People lost their lives in this fire. It was tragic. There was even a firefighter who lost their life. It was a very, very, very sobering moment that climate change is it wasn't like one fire happened. It was like fires all around us were happening. My father's, his winery Continuum lost 30% of their crop. We were very lucky. My brother and I were fine because rain we picked out earlier. We're Pinot Noir, so we bud out earlier. We set and ripen and harvest earlier. So we were fine. But we felt incredibly blessed because we have friends that lost their homes, friends that lost their wineries, friends that lost, like, you know, just, it was just tragic. And so that was the moment where I realized, well, who cares about the soil microbiome and the farm biology if we don't have a planet to live on? And then 2018 happened, wildfires again, similar areas, 2019 happened. And then 2020, the path that 2017, the fires burned, 2020 burned over those paths. The realization that we are in a climate crisis in a state of emergency right now as a planet, and we have to fight for our survival. So long story short, I got the introduction of a lifetime to my co-founders who both, or all three of them, have dedicated their life to the development of incredible technologies. It's actually a fun story. A friend of mine, John, who's in the technology space in autonomous vehicles in a way, I was giving him a tour at Continuum and I said, hey man, I'm looking for autonomy engineers. If you know of anybody, he said, yeah, me too. I'm in this like $1 trillion battle to solve autonomous vehicles. So one day he called me up and he said, hey, come up to the office. And so I drove up to his office and he introduced me to Mark, who's one of my co-founders. And he has a rule at his company, my friend John, and that's that he doesn't hire his friends. And they were college buddies at Cornell University. And so long story short, he introduced me to Mark. Mark is our president, one of my co-founders. His background comes from the early days at Tesla. His first job at Tesla was to double the Roadster production. So he took it from like 10 vehicles a week to like 25 vehicles a week. Then he was involved with aspects of the S factory. Then from there, he went on to build, him and one other gentleman were in charge from sheet to build of the Gigafactory. Then he went on to Romeo Power and Zooks. And along the journey, he met and he hired Praveen and Zachary, the two other co-founders. Praveen, who's our CEO, he's just this incredibly brilliant guy who's been deploying ag tech for the last 10 years. Him, along with Dr. Zachary Mahunder, my other co-founder, you know, his first job out of college was NASA, but his background really is PhD in robotics from Carnegie Mellon. He loves to solve massive technological problems. Him and Praveen have been deploying and solving these crazy technology problems for aerospace, auto, and agriculture. And along the journey, they were deploying these crazy single-use case implements that were costing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And they realized they'd go out in the field with these, like, you know, potato transplanters or romaine lettuce weeders, and they would go hook these up to these tractors, these like really incredible state-of-the-art pieces of technology. And they'd hook it up to the tractor. We need GPS. We need connectivity. We need electric power. So they're like taping onto the tractor all of these things that they need to make their implement work. Quickly enough, they realized that if they could update the tractor, that hasn't been updated in forever. They could make these really important implements a lot less expensive and basically take a lot of the burden off the farm. So that's the really long story. I'm the chief farming officer, so I really am marrying the technology to the farm. But again, it's a dream come true to have a solution. Monarch Tractor, which we've built, is the solution to the Monarch challenge.
It's a great story. And when I first saw your name in your title, CFO, obviously, first thing comes to mind is financial, chief financial officer. But no, you're chief farming officer. And I think an interesting thing about that is you're a farmer, grow grapes. Now you're teaming up with these people from the high-tech world of Silicon Valley. When you bring together people with such diverse experience, experts in one plus experts in another, I think that's an important part of the success that you've had and being able to work together. What was it like at first as a farmer when you first started working with the high-tech world of Silicon Valley?
I'm so inspired by our team. You know, we're now over 100 individuals and they're all incredibly brilliant. And a lot of their families are farmers. So there's a lot of understanding of farming, but it's just incredible. We have people and come from aerospace, auto, not just in the founding team, but within the whole team, aerospace, auto, and getting into, and they're saying, hey, we want to solve this kind of global food chain challenge that we have right now. We want to make our planet better. And the quickest way we can make impact right now is via agriculture. And so it really is. There's the biggest opportunity right now. You know, if you account for agriculture, it's like a quarter of our planet's carbon footprint. And so if we can address that, we can not only make eating and farming and all those things healthier, but we can also protect our planet. So it's an incredible team. They inspire me every single day. I love, one of the things I do when I get to the office is the first thing is I'll just walk around the factory floor and I'll say hello to everybody. And that gives me so much energy.
Do you bring them a bottle of wine for lunch? Is that part of the employment package?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes when we have like holiday parties or things like that, we'll open wine or after out, like when we're done with the day on a Friday type of thing, we'll open some wine and taste. I am reminded by the team that we have a lot of heavy equipment and all that back in the factory. So we can't, but yeah, we absolutely enjoy wine. And there's a lot of people that are really keen on great food and great wine, which is really cool.
It sounds like the desire to make farming better is really key. And that's what pulls your team together. And then you can draw on this diverse experience. You talk about a farmer first mentality. What does that mean? Farmer first mentality.
Farmer first is just the biggest thing. I got involved in this from a farming perspective out of desperate need to have this technology on my farm and to meet the challenge of the Monarch Challenge. So everything that we do at Monarch Tractor is to help farmers, to make their lives easier, to make it less complicated, to make, hopefully at the end of the day, their farms more profitable. In fact, one of the big driving factors of why the Monarch Challenge was going to fail was because of the economic divide. The carbon footprint divide is maybe the most upsetting, but being able to bridge both of those and give farmers the ability to bridge the carbon footprint and economic divide and have them feel good. Because I don't know how many times I've said this, but I don't know a single farmer on this planet that wakes up and says, I want to go spray chemicals, or like, I want to put a hazmat suit on, even if it is to spray an organic contact spray. Nobody wants to do it. To make their lives easier, to also allow for us to bridge away from the dangerous, like non-organic synthetic chemicals, and to be able to get into a way that, you know, we can feed our planet in a healthy way that makes them feel good. So farmer first is at the core of not just my, because I'm a farmer, but the whole entire team at Monarch Tractor has a farmer first mentality. And so also when it comes down to all the technology and all this stuff, because this has a significant amount of technology, all that's owned by the farmers. Something that we were just saying, we are a service provider of building a tractor for you. But once you have that tractor, it's all yours. You can repair it, right to repair, all of those different things that are really controversial right now and kind of the big, big traditional diesel tractor world. We want to get rid of all of that and make life a lot easier for farmers on the technical side. So it's something cool. I think we're going to definitely shake up the tractor universe because of how open we are about that.
Yeah, it's not just selling them a tractor. You're selling them a device that's going to give them what they really want to do. Like you said, they don't really want to spray those chemicals. I'm going to try and do a little summary of some of the things you just said to sort of a little segue into actually your tractor. So you have the butterfly, the flutter of the wing of the butterfly draws your attention to, hey, the environment is not as favorable as it used to be. we got to do something. And obviously, one of the things to do is get away from pesticides. Well, now I'm doing that and doing everything organically, but I got to do it so much. And I'm using this dirty, polluting diesel tractor. I've got to do something about that. And if I do it, it better be cost effective and save people money or be equal or nobody's going to want to do it. And then along comes the electric autonomous Monarch tractor. So how does the Monarch tractor, what is it about the Monarch tractor that solves this problem? Cost-effective, sustainable farming.
Oh, it's so multi-layered. But the biggest thing is that when you spray an organic contact spray, it creates like a shell around the kind of fruit in the canopy. Whereas if you spray like a synthetic, it penetrates and kind of has a lot longer of a half-life. Let's say you're spraying 4 days a week if you're organic and maybe once or twice if you're synthetic and conventional. And so right now, you know, the most dangerous place on a farm, this is a guy who I was a mechanics assistant from when I was seven in our vineyard yard. This guy was super influential to me. I worked with him for a long time. And he said, the most dangerous place on this farm is in the tractor seat. And so when you get to, if you're farming yourself or if you have a team of farmers, when you get into spraying multiple acres, you know, four times a month versus once or twice a month, you realize not only is it really hard to do, it's dirty, it's dangerous. So putting on a hazmat suit and all that is just unattractive. Then you put the cost on top of all that and it's difficult. And then past 6 years, we've had a very difficult time finding tractor drivers. Getting a skilled tractor driver with the new implements that are coming along, it's a lot harder to drive these tractors. It's not as easy as it used to be, let's just say. There's a huge challenge protecting the farmers, and there's a huge challenge finding the farmers willing to do the work. And so by being able to remove the driver by being autonomous, you can have the tractor go out all day, every day, in theory, and have it do work. And you're going to be saving money from if you have someone sitting in that seat. You're also going to be helping that person who would be wearing a hazmat suit. You're going to elevate them to actually managing that fleet. So no longer are they in the contact of the spray that's around. So you're elevating jobs. You're saving a significant amount of money. You can send it out and have that person go do other things while they can observe from their phone, from their, you know, handheld device. And so you're creating a barrier or a bridge away from the incredibly dull and dangerous job of driving the tractor. On top of that, there's the cost of fossil fuel. So diesel is, you know, just to give you an idea right now, turning on one tractor is the equivalent of turning on 14 cars. So they're very, very, very powerful and they're very dirty.
Just the turning on, just the actual turning of the key and turning it on.
Turning on, you can feel it and you can smell it.
It's that big puff of black smoke that comes out the back.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how many times that I've been standing out in the middle of a field in the darkness of the night and the lights are coming off the tractor and the tractor's running and I'm sitting there going, why is the tractor running? The tractor literally is running just to keep the lights on. And you're burning this immense amount of diesel and it's a class one carcinogen. So particulate matter, NOx and CO2, just enveloping the whole entire area where you are. And so being able to get rid of that, you have an immense cost savings on going electric. And that's when hooked up to the grid. If you go down the renewable path, which is what the path I really hope people invest in, and you bridge away from fossil fuel farming, you bridge over the grid into being able to farm your own power plant on your farm, you start to really see the bridge away from the conventional world and into the cleaner kind of world.
Let's break out autonomy and electric just for a second. But what you explained is the autonomy. First of all, there's your savings, right? One person can run multiple tractors. Also, you're elevating the worker. That's even better. It's safer. You're not getting involved with all the herbicides. And then electric on top of that is another layer, which now says, hey, let's get rid of this polluting diesel fuel. One of the things I think that's very surprising that people don't realize is, oh, I'm going to get an electric car and I'm going to contribute to, trying to address global warming, sustainability. But you're only using your car 10% of the time. 90% of the time, it sits in the garage, which is okay. It's not polluting, but it's sitting there. I thought it was interesting that one of the advantages of your electric tractor was we can start the tractors at 4 a.m. now, and the neighbors aren't going to complain. And I thought immediately, wow, if they're starting them at 4 a.m, that means they must be running them quite a bit. How much does a tractor actually run? And how much over a period of a year do you save in emissions and savings in cost for fuel?
That's a really good question because for the growing season, typically when it rains, it pours. You need your tractor immense amount of time from basically spring all the way through to harvest. A little less so in the kind of cooler, dormant months of winter. And this, I'm talking about this for mainly for orchards and fruits and vegetables. There certainly are winter crops as well. But during those peak times, there are moments when you need the tractor a significant amount. It can be upwards of 10, 12, 13 hours. Sometimes you're having two crews coming in, so a daytime and a nighttime crew. So you need the tractor a significant amount during the peak times, like around harvest and during the disease pressure season of, like, you know, the growing season and all that. The autonomy piece is such a massive part to that because nobody wants to do those hours. And again, it's a dangerous job. So if you can kind of be in the comfort of a warm, you know, office, it just makes your life better and managing the fleets from there. And then also, you know, there's a path with this tractor to 24-hour operations. So basically, we have a battery swap cart on the tractor. And so right now, you can swap a battery within about 10 minutes, one person, and put it right back out there. And this works incredible for the farm because it's a closed system for the most part. Farms know where they're going to start and where they're going to end up. It's going to be the same place. It's not like where you have range anxiety with a car when you say, hey, I'm driving from California to New York. Where am I going to sleep tonight? Where am I going to charge my car? Tractors always return to the same tractor barn. So the infrastructure once built is just incredible and so easy to manage. So yeah, you can, in theory, have basically, you know, 19 plus hours of pure operations, which is very difficult to do with a human right now.
In so many ways, agriculture, the things you've just described, the fact you've got the perfect rows, seem like such a great application for autonomy and certainly from a sustainability standpoint for electric drive. Are there a lot of competitors out there?
It's really great because when we began this, you know, you'd go talk to the VCs and whatnot, and they'd be like, oh, this is a really interesting space, but there hadn't been any big exits of technology companies in the ag tech universe. And so they were kind of like, we don't know about this, but we know it's a massive space. Now there's several like single use case robots where you have these incredible technologies that are going to go out and solve weeding or harvesting or all those things, but there's no like true platform where you can get into the tractor, use it and operate it like a normal tractor today. So Monarch, you can basically reverse hook up to your entire implement yard that your diesel tractor hooks up to. You can drive it and operate it like a normal tractor. And then on top of that, you have the autonomy. So not just autonomous driving, but autonomous operations of all the implements. So everything that's hooked up to the PTO, the hydraulic pump, and there's a new little wing of all electric connections for electric implements down the road. You get a lot of data connection, all that stuff. So what we see potentially happening is a lot of these technology robots that are kind of being out there, they're single use case robots, will fold their software and technology into kind of our platform system. And then their algorithms can run certain things for farmers. Because we have, think of it like an Android or an Apple. You can develop apps. So third parties can develop apps and put them onto our tractor. And then the technology, so all the cameras pick up all that data. And then those third parties can benefit, and the farmers at the end of the day are the ones that benefit from having that data that they need, whether it's dealing with, you know, vine health or plant health, or there's a million little things that the data can do. It's literally addresses the three big things on the chemical side, which is fungicides, pesticides, and herbicides. You can eliminate all those with this data, which is cool.
Well, you know, when people think about farm tractors, they probably think it's a corn combine or a wheat harvest. And you're really starting to touch on a lot of things. Certainly, they could do things like that, but also there's going to be the spraying. There's going to be moving bins around, providing power. And you're going even further now, like saying, oh, well, if there's little robotic types of devices that could be implemented, you know, you're sort of creating a platform. And I want to get into that and talk a little bit about those types of things. But first, I want to talk to you about your background.
And I forgot to say, though, Ed, that it's all those things plus electric. So that's and there's a mix of all sorts of things out there. But yeah, it's the fully converged stack is what I should say. Yeah, the farm stack. So yeah.
But that's actually a really good point is underneath it all, the autonomy and the electric provides you those benefits that you've been searching for ever since you saw that monarch butterfly ride and started worrying about it. But it can do so much more than just harvest. And certainly we need to talk about all the tasks, and I'm sure there's many of them, at least in the area of, you know, growing grapes and making wine. Like I say, though, speaking of making wine, your grandfather, Robert Mondavi, an icon of Napa Valley, he must have been an influence. I'm sure he was. How did he influence your life to get you to where you are today?
So my grandfather and I were incredibly close. I say that he and my father, he was Dante and my kind of influential inspiration in terms of the philosophy of life. Just an incredible individual. When you, if you ever had a chance to meet my grandfather, you walked into like an aura of just warmth and good energy. He loved life. He loved nature. He loved wine. He loved food. He loved people. So he influenced us in such an amazing way. When he began Robert Mondavi Winery way back in the day, he was told he was crazy. He began that when it was in 1966. So in 65, he left my family's old winery, Charles Krug. And in 66, he began Robert Mondavi. And he was 53 years old. And he had this dream that he said, we have the soil, we have the climate, we have the know-how to make wines that can sit in the company of the best wines of the world. We just have to invest in the vineyard, into our farming, into how we care for our vineyard. We have to invest into our cellar and how we take care of our cellar and how we clean our cellar. But we have the soil, we have the climate, the know-how to do this. We just have to make those investments. And that actually is what led to him leaving my family's old winery and beginning Robert Mondavi Winery. And that dream that he had, so, you know, he would blind people just trying to think outside of the box. And when he began, those investments came with a lot more of an expense than, you know, the normal wines coming from California. It was at a time when what he said was crazy. You asked someone at that time, can you make wines outside of France or Italy that can sit with the best wines of the world? People would say, absolutely not. There was no Australia. There was no Argentina. There was none of these really incredible wine regions around the world that there are now. He had that dream. And one of the great realizations of that was when Baron Philippe de Rothschild said, he's one of the five first growths of Bordeaux. I'd like to come to California and make wine with you, Robert. And they began a project. And my father, meanwhile.
And the name of that project?
Opus One. My father was the one behind the scenes in the cellar and in the vineyards. And so the wonderful thing about wine is right now I can open a bottle of wine from the 60s and the 70s and I can think about what my grandfather was doing. So his wines continue to inspire Dante and I to this day. And then my father was our fund. So he was our technical viticulturalist and enologist for my family. He still is for a continuum for my family. Still one of our greatest fundamental teachers. And so he, thinking back to those wines, and he continues to inspire Dante and I on the wine side. But I think my grandfather inspired Dante and I, particularly me, with his philosophy of life.
He was always ready to try something new. He never gave up.
One of the testaments to that was amazing. So he was the first one to use stainless steel in the wine business, and he pioneered stainless steel from the milk industry. And he said, you know, right now we don't understand what Brettanomyces and Eniococcus and Pediococcus, all these different bacteria, we don't understand what they are. We don't know how to clean them. We don't even know what malolactic fermentation is and how that's happening. This was a time when there was so much science and studying going on in the science of the cellar and fermentation. So he said, well, I don't want to inherit last year's challenges. I want to start with a blank canvas. So he went to the milk industry, pioneered stainless steel. I remember, I still get goosebumps when I think about this. We were at Chateau Aubryon, which is one of the wonderful and one of the oldest first growths wineries in Bordeaux. And Jean-Paul Dalmas said, Robert, these tanks are here because of you. So my grandfather influenced this guy who was being told you're crazy for starting a winery that you think you can make wines that can sit in the company.
Became the student.
Yeah, helped change the way that so many of us make wine around the world. And he was very humble too. He was not but a very sweet man. So just the way he lived his life and the way that he considered himself a steward of the land, as my father does and Dante and I do. And he was just a great visionary and a great person.
When making wine, you put the wine in the barrel, in the oak barrel. It gives it certain flavors that oak can impart onto the wine. However, a lot of care needs to go into those barrels. Like you started to mention, different bacteria or who knows what, if you don't take really, really good care. So now you put it in a stainless steel tank. How do you get that oak flavor and all the flavors? There must be another part to that as well.
Yeah. And that gets to be, it's such an interesting conversation, Ed, because he also back then went to using all new oak barrels. Because again, you could start with a blank canvas and not inherit any of the bacterial problems that from the vintage that might have had before, because we didn't understand microbiology at the level we do now. And so he was using a very clean blank canvas with each harvest for the best fruit. Now that we understand microbiology at a higher level, we can clean these barrels. And the one wonderful thing about oak versus stainless steel is the micro-oxygenation and the way that oak can allow for a wine to age. But when you have a delicate variety like Pinot Noir, for example, which my brother and I make with Rain, and you use a new barrel, you have all those aldehydes, so like vanillin, all the spice that comes out of that wood and imparts its flavor and aromas into the juice. And for us, we spend so much time farming, and we have what we consider to be California Grand Cru sites, three special sites. We farm 18 and a half acres with rain on the Sonoma coast. We don't necessarily want the oak characteristic. We want the characteristic of the microflora of the vineyard and all that.
Stainless steel is an advantage there, then you have more control.
Yeah. And so where we, my grandfather went to the right path to get closer to terroir, which was to basically eliminate any potential microbiological challenge that could face. We've gone, now that we understand microbiology, even closer to terroir than he was able to get, because we're able to clean our barrels. We're able to have very, very clean, pure wines without the oak characteristics. The best way to think about it, Ed, would be like you go to a Michelin three-star restaurant and they serve this unbelievable cut of fish or this unbelievable cut of meat or this unbelievable vegetable. They're going to try to nowadays, I think the best ones that I've been to minimally spice it. So it's what you're tasting really is the meat or
the
essence. And so instead of piling on béarnaise sauce or something heavy and drowning the flavors with the sauce, it's the same thing with wine. So it's been this evolution, and that's because we're incredibly proud of our site. So when you get into wines that might not have maybe the great terroir and the great care, oak is a great way to mask anything that might not be perfect. So using a lot of new oak, for example, or in the event, what you were saying, you could put oak chips into a stainless steel tank and do things like that, which are practices we don't do. And I'm fortunate right now. We're very small and we get to play with just the best fruit. So, but there's a whole range of winemaking that exists out there.
It must have been great growing up in the family of pioneer like that, got you all ready to go, you know, start your own rain vineyard. And in fact, one of the reasons you went to the Sonoma Coast is you like to surf. You're also a professional snowboarder. You started a line of skincare products made from grapes. How does a surfing, snowboarding skincare specialist transition from that back to making wine? Because I'm sure you start off when you were young with your grandfather walking in the vineyard, tasting grapes, snowboard. I don't know. It sounds great. Snowboarding and surfing. But then you switch back.
I knew from a young age that I wanted to make wine and be in the wine business. I knew from when I was 7 years old. And it was kind of one of those things where I don't know what my grandfather and father did, but I knew I wanted to do what they do. And then every single year as I worked in the vineyard yard and I worked in the vineyard and then I worked in the cellar, I kept confirming that that's what I wanted to do. Meanwhile, on the side, I grew up in an area where I was skateboarding in Napa and Sonoma, surfing on the Sonoma coast, and then eventually began snowboarding. And I just loved being outdoors. We have great surf spots in the Sonoma coast. It's really cold water and a little bit more off the beaten path than like some of the Point Breaks you find like in Southern California or around the world. But it's one of the most beautiful places to surf. I think it's incredible. And you're surrounded by beautiful kind of little valleys and little areas where they just make some of the best wine in the world. It's a special place.
I want to get back to your tractor and the technology, but how do you make a skincare product from grapes?
That,
or grape leaves or
that actually,
how do you get an idea to do that?
Well, that came from a friend of mine who was a professional snowboarder, actually. We went on a surf trip to Indonesia and to the Mentawai Islands. This is a long story, but it was with Bob Hurley, one of my sponsors at the time was Hurley Clothing, and we had a group of surfers and snowboarders that went on this incredible trip. And it was just like an amazing trip. And my friend Josh, who's an incredible entrepreneur and a brilliant guy. So we had this waste at the winery, right? You take the skins and seeds and pumice and all that. And you kind of, we were getting rid of it. Now we use it for compost. Dante and I use it for compost, but it was kind of this polyphenol rich, antioxidant rich, beautiful kind of material. And so I met up with a friend of mine, Josh, who's this incredible guy, and just said, how do we do something with this? And I'm no longer involved in any of that, but I just was kind of the guy who was able to help come up with some of the ingredients, because I was in the cellar with every harvest and just said, hey, here you go. So
yeah, see what you can do with this.
Yeah, not deeply involved, but definitely.
It doesn't turn your skin purple or anything like that, of course.
During winemaking, yeah, your hands are, you know, my hands just lost the layer of crust of like all the beautiful tannins and all that. But no, in a skincare kind of thing, I don't think that that's what people want. So
your current winery and vineyard you have with your brother, Rain, spelled R-A-E-N. Where'd that name come from? Interesting name.
So it's a longer story, but it came from a story that my dad, my father, Tim, told my brothers and sisters and I when we were little. And when we were little, if you go to the winery and you're, that was our hiding and go seek kind of playground. And so tanks and all sorts of stuff. And you see all these things, forklifts, and it's larger than life. I literally thought that, you know, we had a laboratory and all this stuff. And so I felt like we were closer to NASA than to how natural wine is. And we had, you know, lab coats and all that. My dad told me us the story of, he said, you guys realize that wine is the most natural beverage you can have, that the alchemy or miracle of water becoming wine happens every year in the vineyards. And he told us the story of Rain becoming wine. And he said, you know, if you think about it, if rain falls in the fields, filters through the rocks, the vines drink, the sun sweetens it. And then on the outside of the grape, there's this wax that collects the native yeast that's floating through the air. So it collects all of the different microflora. So the resin from the flowers, the grasses, the trees, the dirt, all of that, which we call a terroir, all that sticks to that wax and creates the bloom. And within the bloom, there's just, it's loaded with native yeast. There's over 50,000 individual yeast cells on that wax. And so if you do nothing at all, and we see this every year, bee will bite the grape open or a bird pecks it open. The juice mixes with the skin sugar plus yeast yields alcohol right there without intervention. Rain becomes wine. And then Dante and I, when we began Rain, we knew we wanted to farm as a permaculture and biodynamics and go beyond organic and really push the limit of where we can go in terms of farming within the forest and not having edges, just have it flow through. And so the unique spelling R-A-E-N was something that we had trying to come up with a way to express what we were doing. R-A-E-N stands for our dedication to research in agriculture and enology naturally. So all of our wines are natively fermented. We don't add yeast. We don't allow yeast in the winery. We don't fine, we don't filter. And we went with A for agriculture instead of V for viticulture because we believe in kind of a polyculture, or we believe in biodiversity. And this is how we're going to save our planet too, is biodiversity. When we start seeing a loss of life is when we are on that timeline. And biodiversity is going to be, and that's all in plant life and in organism life and all those things. Biodiversity is how we're going to save this planet. And so we wanted to make sure that, you know, we talked about biodiversity and that we stressed biodiversity and that we had an incredibly diverse farm. So we're a little bit doing some really fun things, but it's been an incredible journey with Rain.
I like that description of the Mondavi vineyards, and your father's vineyard was in Napa Valley and the lab coats you were describing, all that. And then you make the transition to Sonoma, go a little bit more natural. And for those out there, there's Napa and Sonoma County. They're right next to each other. It's the wine county of Northern California, and they have different personalities. Since I've been there, I've spent most of my time when I visit in Sonoma, and it does have a more laid back, a more relaxed feel to it. And there, I saw a T-shirt there once when I was in Sonoma, and it said, Sonoma makes wine and Napa makes auto parts. And for our international listeners, Napa is an auto parts store, very famous auto parts store. Is there any truth to that? Do you think that?
No. That is so ridiculous. Whoever made that is a phenomenal comedian. But no, that's just, I mean, Napa auto parts, there's Napa auto parts, but, you know, Napa Valley.
It is a different feel, though, from Napa to Sonoma, I think, a little bit. Would you say?
So I think they're so different in their terroirs and what they deliver in terms of what's in the bottle. You know, my father and my grandfather began Continuum up on Pritchard Hill. It's an incredibly diverse area. And so I just also going back, you know, we no longer own Robert Mondavi Winery. We sold Robert Mondavi Winery in 2004. It's a long story. Turned out to be, I think, the best thing that could have happened to my family because my grandfather was around to begin Continuum with my father, Tim. They began with, you know, it's a family project up on Pritchard Hill, but we stopped making anything but that one wine. And so Dante and I, you know, I went to college in France, worked in Burgundy. My brother Dante's a crazy Pinot Noir guy. My dad's a crazy Pinot guy and my grandfather. So finally in 2013, we went to the Sonoma Coast. And we went to the Sonoma Coast because first off, right in front of where our vineyards are is one of the deepest and coolest channels of water on the planet. It's just this incredible fresh, cool body of water that creates an incredibly cool climate that you can ripen Pinot Noir in, but you cannot, you know, you could ripen Cabernet there, but it would have a totally different characteristic than it does in Napa Valley. And there are parts of Sonoma, by the way. It's one of the amazing things about Sonoma is that you can have areas that ripen Syrah, Cabernet. It's a very, because as you get closer to, because it does share a property line, like you were saying, it gets warmer, that is more ideally suited for thicker skinned, later ripening varieties. And then the true coast out there where it's very cool is more ideal for thin skinned, earlier ripening varieties. But they're very different terroirs. They're very different sites. And so you get really into the depths of the artistry of wine. But in terms of vibes, there's a really cool young scene happening in Napa right now, which is, I think, injecting a lot of really cool energy into what's going on. And same with the Sonoma Coast. There's a lot of really cool young winemakers making some just incredible stuff. So both areas are really exciting, just slightly different.
And equal skills in making auto parts or selling them, I guess, right?
So yeah, that's hilarious.
Carlo, as always, we finish up our rapid fire section with a set of real quick questions with quick answers. Are you ready to go?
Sure am. Yeah.
All right. What was the first car you ever bought or owned?
I always had hand-me-down cars. My family was very much a hand-me-down kind of family. So I had like the third used car from, it was my mom and my sister, then my older sister, and then me. But the first thing I bought that was like really cool that I was pumped on was actually a motorcycle, a 2004 Dyna Super Glide Harley Davidson. And I still have it. I love it.
Did you pass your driver's test on the first try?
No, actually I did not. It's funny. It was a weird turn lane and I totally blew it. I was so embarrassed, but I got it the second time.
Did you ever get a speeding ticket on that motorcycle?
No, not on the motorcycle. No, I've been lucky there.
On the tractor?
No, not on the tractor. Thankfully, geez, that'd be scary. Yeah, the Monarch, we had to put a governor on it because it could go really fast.
On Future Car Podcast, we always talk about the living room on wheels, which is if it's fully autonomous, right? You're in a vehicle that's fully autonomous. You don't have to drive. You can do whatever you want. So you're on a 5-hour trip. You're on your living room on wheels. What do you have in your living room on wheels? Ideal, perfect, Carlo Mondavi, living room on wheels, 5-hour trip.
Well, I mean, of course, if it's autonomous and you're not driving, you have to have a little wine cellar, you know, so some delicious bottles of wine, some delicious, maybe it's as casual as, you know, some bread and cheese, or maybe it's, you know, something that you're diving into. But I do think that's so cool, being able to like enjoy a glass of wine and have an autonomous view. If that happens, I think that it would be something with wine, great wine.
What person, living or not, would you want to spend that 5-hour car ride with?
Oh, that'd be my grandfather. We were really, really, really close. And you never get to spend enough time with someone who's influenced you like my grandfather influenced me. So I would definitely, it'd be my grandfather. Yeah.
If you had a time machine and you could go back in time to your 12-year-old self where you're, that was there, what advice would you give to the 12-year-old Carla?
You know, I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, and my life has been anything but easy. All the challenges and stuff that I've done that's been stupid has led to like kind of where I am now. So I wouldn't want to give myself any advice that would alter where I've come to at this point. There's a ton of things I would say, but
top one, what's the most, you could only give him one piece of advice. What would it be?
I mean, I think it would be what my grandfather always told me, which is just to follow your heart and soul and, you know, keep being you, which is essentially what my grandfather told me. Pour your heart and soul into whatever you do in life. Just a lot of the teachings my grandfather taught me are exactly what I tell myself. And I already knew around that age. He'd always say common sense is uncommon. The greatest risk you can take in life is not taking a risk at all. All of those things, he kind of molded the greatest advice I've ever gotten and the same advice I'd give myself.
That's part one of our talk with Carlo Mondavi. Join us again for part two, where Carlo explains the technology behind Monarch's electric autonomous tractor. And as always, for more information about Siemens digital industry software, make sure to visit us at plm.automation.siemens.com. And until next time, I'm Ed Bernardin, and this has been the Future Car Podcast.